welcome to the Voice of the People with your host, November Hansen.
The Voice of the People Radio. May it be a fine day to all of you who have joined us, wherever you may be on this lovely planet of ours. There are many listening venues to tune into your favorite paranormal radio network programming by internet, by cell phone, using UpSnap. Just dial 704-631-4060 and enter your four-digit station ID code, which is 2899. If you happen to be in the New Orleans area, you can listen to 105.5 FM on your radio. My website is www.voiceofthepeopleradio.com for a list of upcoming guests. And if you go there, yes, half of my site is missing. I have no idea what happened to it. I'll have to check into that later. This evening, my guest is going to be researcher and writer R.S. Khan. And I just don't got that accent thing going. R.S. Khan is a London-based researcher and writer most noted for his work as editor of the Tomb of Jesus website. His academic and professional interests center around computer science and IT. From the age of 19, he has had research articles published in magazines and journals on a variety of theological, historical, and social issues. A strong personal interest in the Jesus in India theory, along with his IT background, meant Arif was an ideal candidate for editor of the Tomb of Jesus website, a position he has held since 2003. The website has become the online center for Jesus in India studies, bringing together research material from Christian, Judaic, Islamic, Hindu, and Buddhist sources in a rich multimedia experience. Arif has had letters published in several national newspapers in the United Kingdom, including The Times, The Independent, The Guardian, and The Scotsman. His letters have been on issues ranging from the veil and protest after the Muhammad caricatures of the Archbishop of Canterbury comments on the Da Vinci Code. Arif appears in Paul David's 2008 film, Jesus in India, providing analysis on a number of topics, including the theory that Jesus survived the crucifixion, the lost tribes of Israel in India, the Islamic responses and varying beliefs on Jesus, and the Rosabal tomb in Kashmir. Arif Khan also took part in a panel questions and answers session after the premiere of the film in Palm Springs, California, in October 2008. Arif, there are so many things I can say. You've had such an extraordinary life for such a young man. I think I'm going to let you speak for yourself. You are a member of a Muslim community. I apologize. I cannot pronounce the name.
Yeah, it's Ahmadiyya.
Ahmadiyya, okay. And, you know, I thought maybe, Arif, that would be a good place to start. Could you tell us a little bit about the Ahmadiyya Muslim community?
Yep, I can definitely do that. So my interest in this topic, I mean, it's often a common question that, you know, how did you get interested? And, being a member of this community, I was born into this community. Interestingly, it's quite a recent community. It was actually founded in 1889, so in the last 150 years, and it's a very controversial community, I should say, as well. The one of the beliefs we're talking about here is Jesus in India, and that is a belief held by the community, so indifference. We'll get into a bit more detail on this later, but something that definitely separates us from the other Muslims is our belief that Jesus did travel to India, and that his final resting place was in Kashmir. Now, who are some of these, you know, what's their background? Even such a simple question as this, requires a fair amount of explanation. As you were listing the topics we've got on Tomb of Jesus, you saw we're talking about Islam, Christianity, Judaism. There's a huge range of material covered here. But let's have a go. So the Ahmadiyya community. Now it turns out that there were, if you look at all religions, there's prophecies that in the latter days or towards the end of time, a figure, a prophet of some kind will come and unite the world. So we have the traditions of the second coming of Jesus in Christianity. You've got in Islam, there's also similar traditions about actually Jesus himself. And there's also a figure known in Islamic terminology as the Imam Mahdi, which means the guided Imam. But also, if you look in other faiths, in Buddhism, there's talk, Buddha always coming back. even the Zoroastrians believe in Zoroaster returning. So there seems to be a common theme that towards the end of time, when there is a lot of corruption and, you know, there's a lot of faith has disappeared, there'll be a time when a figure or some community will be sent to try and revive things or bring things together. Now, often some people believe that it will be a separate person, there'll be someone coming for each of these religions, but the claim of the founder of the Ahmadiyya community was that, no, all these people are going to come, you know, there's one person who's going to fulfill this mission, and, you know, it's to bring everyone together and fulfill all these various prophecies and, you know, come together under one banner. So that huge claim was his claim, that he was this person who was, this was his mission. Now, prior to that, it's interesting to talk about the person who founded the community. His name is Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, and he was born in Qadian, which is a village in India, around 1835 was when he was born. So initially, he was born into an Islamic background. He was very much a Muslim. And his initial work that he did in India was actually defending Islam from the attack from its opponents at the time. So a lot of the allegations that were made against Islam at the time, the Muslims were not over to counter, but they were very impressed with his rebuttal. So he gave very detailed explanations, wrote many books, explaining exactly what the true teaching of Islam was. And at that time, you know, he was the savior, if you like, for the Muslims. They loved him. Things changed, however, when he started to say that he was receiving divine revelation. Now, we should probably explain why this would be an issue. Muslims, a lot of the Muslim world believes that after Muhammad, who founded Islam, 570 AD, many Muslims tend to believe that, you know, that was it in terms of prophets and saviors. This was the final prophet. There can be no one after that. So when a Muslim starts saying, you know, God is talking to me, it starts sending alarm bells off in the Muslim world. So, you know, they thought, okay, you know, he's still making fairly conservative claims. He's helping us. We'll go with him. But then when he started to make claims saying that, no, God has told me that, you know, the person who is awaited towards the end of time is yourself, and, you know, he's saying that it is me, this is my mission, you know, that's when they started to really turn against him. Then when he said that not only, you know, am I fulfilling prophecies from Islam, but, you know, just like the Hindus are awaiting Krishna, I am the second coming of Krishna. Now, he was using metaphorical language, but straight away people turned against him. And I suppose from that moment on, really, the Ahmadis have been sort of attacked, seen as a minority group that are outside the pale of Islam. Promised Messiah, or Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, when he passed away, he was 73 years old. This was about 1908. And despite coming from a very small town that no one really knew in India, he had about I think, around 300,000 followers at the time of his death, which is 1908. Now, something quite crucial, actually, is what happened next. After he passed away, he set into flow a system of Khilafat, or successors. Now, even in the early days of Islam, when the Prophet Muhammad passed away, there were people who took on over from him. So the first Khalifa successor was Abu Bakr, who was one of his closest companions. So what that gave was, it gave the Muslims a leader and a central point, and, you know, basically a leader, someone they could unite under. But if you look at the history of early Islam, what happened was, after three or four of these successors, things broke down and the Muslims got completely dispersed. They ended up in so many different factions. But what happened with the Ahmadiyya Muslims was, again, this system of Khilafat, or successorship, was begun again. So after Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad passed away in 1908, there was an appointed leader, or Khalifa, who followed him. And that system of Khilafat, or leadership, actually continues to this very day. So right now we're currently on the fifth successor, who's actually based in London, England, not far from where I'm taking this call today, actually. His name is Hazrat Mirza Masroor Ahmad. He was elected to that position in 2003. Now, the reason to stress this is because currently today, one of the biggest issues in the Muslim world is the lack of a single point, like a leader, or even just unity. There's so much division, and, you know, often the Muslims get upset that people have a negative image about them, or they don't, you know, they're not sure what their viewpoint is on such and such. Well, one reason is because there is no single voice for the Muslims, or there's no, you know, single person who can control them, but single spokesman, if you like. Now, there's some who like to say, get away from organized religion, but the Islamic Khilafat is very much a spiritual thing rather than something taken to, you know, sort of control the people. It's a spiritual leader you would consult on matters of spirituality. They're not interested in implementing laws or anything like that. So that's one key difference, that the Ahmadiyyas have this system of Khilafat. So, you know, that's in a very quick overview. That's basically what the community stands for. So they claim that the founder was here to not only unite religions, but also to remove innovations and correct errors that had occurred in the religion of Islam. So even as far back as 1889, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, who founded the community, spoke in depth about his concern and his worry about some of the elements that were creeping into Islam. and he specifically talked about that there's some amongst the Muslims who, you know, will happily or will be, take someone else's life and think that they're doing something very good just because that person has a different belief. So even back then, we're talking 100 odd years ago, there was talk of this terrorism and extremism. And there and then, he nipped it in the bud, essentially, and explained exactly why that's nothing to do with the teaching of Islam. At that time in India, the British Raj were actually in power, and there was much talk about whether the Muslims were able, whether they should be allowed to protest or rise up against the British. And he came out and said explicitly that if there's a ruling power who allows you to practice your faith, there's no evidence, there's no basis for you to rise against them. So he preached that his message was definitely one of peace and love as well. And for that as well, he was attacked, saying that, you know, Islam does allow you to rise up against people and, you know, there is a tradition and what is this innovation that you're bringing in? So that's another thing interesting to note, because in recent years, as you can see, many of the attacks of Islam have been due to this angle, and the Ahmadis have been committed to peace for such a long time. In fact, the current slogan that the community holds is love for all, hatred for none.
Arif, I want to make sure that I understand this right.
Sure.
So what you're saying is that this form of Islam, and forgive me if I use the wrong terms or wrong language, because I know a little bit about it. I'm not heavily educated.
That's fine.
Actually not in a whole lot of religions. Anyway, I guess I have a different way of looking at things. But I guess what I want to ask and make sure I understand, that in your particular form of Islam, the one that you practice,
yes,
it is okay to accept people from other religions, from different faiths.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. That's what I wanted to make sure. I do think that we do have a misperception of, you know, in America, actually in other places too, you hear the terms Muslim or you hear the term Islam, and of course terrorists is the first thing that comes to mind. I think we can blame our media for that,
mm-hmm,
because that's the predominant thing in the media, when it really is just, I think, a small fraction of the people. I've met many Muslim people, and they're great. They're no really, they love their kids, they have their jobs, they're a different faith. Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, when I was thinking about coming on the show and we had a list of topics, I thought about, as soon as I mentioned Islam, we can have a two-hour program right there talking about the misconceptions about Islam. It's probably the most, there's more misconceptions about that than any religion at all.
I just wanted the listeners to have a basis on who you were and where you were coming from.
Yeah, yeah.
And not to be, you know, if I mentioned Muslim or Islam, to say, oh, no, not one of those programs
I've
been seeing, you know? But we do those things, and it's very unfortunate. So I'm glad that you explained that to us, and I'm sure that we'll hear bits and pieces of it throughout the program too. Okay, so you've had kind of a rough life, actually. You've overcome some very, you know, big obstacles, and I think that's just amazing, and your attitude is just wonderful. Oh, and I do want to say, too, Arif is a proud father of a beautiful little girl that I've seen pictures of. Oh, the expressions in this child's face is just amazing. So congratulations.
Thank
on
you very much
for that. Okay, so let's go back to the Jesus in India video.
Yep.
How did you actually get involved? Did Paul Davies approach you? Was it something that you seen somebody doing some work on and you were interested and contacted them? How did you get into all of this?
To explain that, I'd best to explain how I got involved in the Tomb of Jesus website, because it was through that really that Paul found me.
Okay.
The Tomb of Jesus site, so we're in the internet age here, and like I said before, the Ahmadis have this belief that Jesus did travel to Kashmir. So it's quite interesting. I mean, I've grown up in London, UK, all my life. And so even going to school, you're aware that there's a very different belief of Jesus there. So, you know, I also was very much aware that my belief was different. And like we'll get into a bit later, even within Islam, I was aware that my belief was very different as well. So I'm thinking, I've thought about this myself. I think that probably gave me a bigger sense of identity. You take someone into and you make them a minority, and if they're a minority of a minority, if you like, You tend to get a very strong sense of identity and knowing exactly what you stand for and what your beliefs are. And I think that's probably why, from a sort of quite early age, I was very interested in to know, you know, where our beliefs differed from what we were taught at school, for instance. So the crucifixion and, you know, such things, you know, I was aware that we believed something else. So I would ask, an older brother who's 7 years old and a few younger brothers and sisters, and I would ask my older brother about this, you know, well, what happened? What happened at the crucifixion? Is this true? You know, what is this based on? And, you know, he was able to give me quite a few answers. But then we get to the internet age, I suppose, and I think it's whenever people go to university or college or things like that, they have a lot more time on their hands to look into what their real interests are. I think we become much rounder people and we pursue our interests. And I think around about that time, which is probably when I was about 17 or 18 years old, when I was going through my degree, like I said, computer science, not related to this stuff, that was probably the time when I started looking into this theory and was told about this website, the Tomb of Jesus website. Now, what struck me right away is that from a very early age, I'd been told exclusively about the Jesus in India theory from an Ahmadi point of view, that, you know, this is a belief of the Ahmadi Muslims. And I was amazed to find on this website that there were sources from many other faiths as well. So there was a Hindu document on there that was shown as one of the main documents. There was talk about Jesus in Buddhism as well. And there was obviously Christian material and a lot of stuff about Christianity as well. So that was what initially aroused my interest. And what was quite interesting and different, I think, about the Tomb of Jesus site is that up until then, the books and material I'd read on it, like I said, was from an Ahmadi point of view, but also it was quite kind of polemic, I would say. There was quite a lot of theology and religion all tied behind everything, whereas the Tomb of Jesus site presented the material in a more objective way. So, again, the modern age of the internet, I mean, I ordered a book from there, which was called Saving the Savior. The author of that was Abu Bakr Salahuddin, was his name. And I read this book, and then at the end of it, I could literally, the age of email, send an email to the author and say, you know, I have a few questions, what do you think of such and such? And straight away I got a response. And that was how it began. So the Abu Bakr is the guy's name. He was the one who originally authored the website. Now, he himself came from an Ahmadi background. But later on, after a few years as well, he changed his religious beliefs slightly, and it was around that time that I got more involved in the website, and he got to a stage where he said, you know, I still believe in this Jesus in India theory, but it's quite controversial, and I'm not sure I want to be involved in it anymore. And that was a stage where, just so happened, that was the perfect time for me to get more involved. So I think we're talking about, it seems a while ago, 2004 would be roughly about that time. Now, I'd come out of university. I had, IT and programming, computing was my background, as well as a huge interest in this material. So I was able to work on the website, get information together. One thing that the website tried to do, it's quite important to understand its scope. I was never claiming that I was, a scholar or an expert in this theory and, you know, that I was going to write a big thesis on this, although it's tempting now. But what I did claim to do was to... the aim of the site was to collate the existing material. There's so many very good books on this topic, and the material, like I was saying before, is spread across so many faiths that it's, I don't know, often I'd speak to people and they would have one part of the jigsaw, and the idea of the website was to bring it all together. So that was what the Tomb of Jesus site essentially did and does, and I think it was around about 2004 and 5 that there seemed to be a real increase in the interest in this topic. Not just visitors on the site, but we used to get requests from filmmakers and film producers. Now, Paul David's film is actually the third film that I was involved in to some extent, but it's the first and only one so far that has actually made it out. So prior to Paul David, there were at least two other filmmakers who were interested in producing documentaries on this very topic. Both of them were based in the UK, though. One planned a three-part documentary talking about this material, and another planned a sort of an hour-long documentary looking at this material. But their proposals were rejected, and they were given different reasons for why, you know, this material, they were told it was too controversial, we don't really want to go there, we're in a time when we want to bring religions together where this topic is seen as something controversial, and that will cause controversy, which is an interesting approach, because if you look at Paul David's film, it's completely the opposite. So that was where these people were coming from. And then I think it was, there's a researcher called Suzanne Olsen who also appears in the film, a good friend of mine. And she was the one who actually put me in touch with Paul and said that, you know, there's a documentary maker I'm aware of, Paul Davies, who's working on this film. And then it so happened, I mean, the way these things work are quite amazing. It so happened that Paul happened to be in London anyway. His wife works for Universal Studios. There was a launch of a new musical, and he was going to be there. And he dropped an email to me and said, you know, I've heard about you. People have said that, you know, we should meet up. And I thought this was a great opportunity for the website. I took it as a great opportunity. I could interview him, get some information about what the film is, what his background is, you know, write up an interview or something like that. So that was my aim for meeting up. And it also so happened when I looked at where he was staying, the hotel he was staying happened to be about 5 minutes walk away from where I was working at the time as well. So, you know, we arranged and we said, you know, he'll ring me. And I was thought on my lunch hour, I'd go and speak to him. So it's quite a nice little anecdote, actually. What happened was he rang me that day, and I remember speaking to him at work, and his first question was, are you dressed as you would like to appear on film?
Oh.
And that completely took me aback. And, you know, I tried sort of saying to him, well, you know, initially when we meet, let's just have a talk. I'd be interested to know where your project's going, what you've done. And, you know, I tried sort of delaying a bit, and he said, sure, fine, you know, just come to the hotel and we'll have a chat and we'll see how it goes. But literally, I met him, he gave me a 5-minute overview of the film, and then he said, you know, let's turn the camera on and start talking, and that's literally what happened. So there was no preparation as anything, it was just like, you know, we just started having a chat, and first session went on for about an hour and a half, I think.
Do you sometimes think that maybe things happen in life for a reason and pieces fall into place because that's where you were supposed to be at that time?
Absolutely. I mean, interestingly, I was only at that company for a few months after that. And, Paul was literally around the corner, which meant I was able to go that day and the next couple of days as well. So, yep, certainly in the right place at the right time.
Okay, Arif, I have a question from somebody in the virtual auditorium.
Sure.
I think it's a legitimate question, so I'm going to ask it.
Yep.
Is there any physical trace case type evidence for Christ existing anywhere as an assigned document, taxes paid, something like that, or is this only from the Bible and the Quran?
Yeah, brilliant question, because many people don't realize, actually it's kind of an issue that you face with any study on Jesus, mm-hmm. And I found this more and more often, is that it's a little known fact, but there's very few references to him outside of the Bible. And here we're still talking references before we even get into the physical evidence. There's very little, very few references outside the Bible. We have a couple. We have some mentions of him in Josephus' writing, who's a Jewish historian, and Tacitus as well, who's a famous Roman historian. But again, there's evidence that maybe these were tampered with later. So there's very often you hear people say that, you know, okay, there's two things. Some people say that Christ never existed. There was no physical person. That's one approach. And often you'll get people saying with the Jesus in India theory that how can you revise something so established? How could, you know, the established history of him in Jerusalem be dismissed? And you come up with something crazy and, you know, you've got very few documents to prove it. But what we tend to see is that there's actually a lot, well, arguably there's a lot more evidence physical in terms of various documents about Jesus in the Jesus in India theory. And from if I put my Jesus in India hat on, I can say, well, physically there seems to be a tomb in Kashmir, and there seems to be feet carvings related to that tomb that relate to this person. But other than the India evidence, in terms of physical evidence, there's very, very little. The person who made that comment has got a very legitimate point. And I did spend quite a lot of time looking at people who claim that maybe he didn't exist at all as a historical figure.
You know, I do think that he existed. If you give me the Jesus in India theory, okay, now it's going to make sense. I always had problems earlier on. Here you had this person from history named Jesus. This person was the type of person that you would expect would be able to unite people, that, you know, taught, I don't know, just wonderful things about how we should live our lives. But it was in such contradiction to what the other pieces of the Bible were, you know, fire and brimstone and this type of thing. But then when you look at Buddhism, I believe it is, and their types of teachings, it's very similar, isn't it?
Yeah, there are definite similarities there as well.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
Although, just to come back on that, November, it's not...
Okay.
I mean, one thing that should be mentioned is that the Ahmadis tend to not agree fully with the idea of Jesus traveling to India as a child. Mm-hmm. It's quite an interesting one. I mean, on our website, we've obviously delved into it, and Paul David's film spends a lot of time looking at it. But one thing I would say, it certainly makes a lot of sense. One thing I would say, though, is that it is possible that without him delving or learning from other faiths, that even within Judaism, you know, even within Islam or any religion, there's different aspects of it. And it's almost as if Jesus felt at that time that the people or the Pharisees had become so heavily reliant on the law and the letter of the law that they'd lost the spiritual side. So even within Judaism, there is this spirituality, but you're right that his teachings tended to focus on that point. But I think it's possible that it could have come from an appreciation of other faiths, but it could equally have come from within Judaism as well.
Okay, fair enough. Now, the Jesus in India theory, that's not just something that popped up overnight, correct? There is, I believe it's oral tradition that he did actually travel to India amongst people who lived there. Yeah. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one thing is that the, this is coming back to the Ahmadi thing, is that the rest of the Muslim world initially have even to this day, have rejected the Ahmadi faith. We are ostracized, you know, there's the persecution that occurs. In 1974, it's worth noting that it was actually passed by law in Pakistan that the Ahmadis have no right to refer to themselves as Muslims or call their place of worship a mosque. Now, what's interesting is that the Ahmadis have also spoken about the Jesus in India theory. So the majority of the Muslim world, so many people, if they come across this theory, as soon as they realize that there's a connection with this sect, the Ahmadis, they're not going to look at the theory at all. So one thing is that, yeah, they should appreciate that there's, you know, you can't do that. Unfortunately, that doesn't work. You could take the Ahmadis and you could take our founder, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, out of the equation, and there's still such an amazing amount and breadth of evidence on this topic from so many different faiths and religions. So we've got the oral traditions you mentioned. There's also one of the oldest documents that mentions this is the Bahavishya Mahapurana, which is a Hindu document. And you know, no Ahmadi's influence there. That dates, apparently it dates to about around the 1st century AD, and that talks about a figure known as Isa Masih, is the name that the person gave. It was basically the king of the time came across a saintly figure dressed in white, who said that his name was Isa Masih, that he had come from a foreign land to escape persecution. And when asked, what religion did you teach? He said, I teach a religion of love. And it even says in that document that he said that he was born of a virgin. So that is from a Hindu source. And then as explored on Paul David's film about Jesus traveling to India during the missing years, that source, mainly what we draw upon is the St. Isa document. So in the film you talk a lot about Nicholas Notovich and the document he saw. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a Buddhist source. So, and these traditions and oral traditions tend to go back hundreds and hundreds of years. What is quite interesting is when you speak to the people, when you hear about what the people in Kashmir themselves believe. We'll get into later about the Orthodox Islamic belief on Jesus. But what is fascinating and what I quite enjoyed was listening to the actual interviews of the people living very close to that tomb. Because although their dogma will say, no, it can't be Jesus in that tomb, however, still, what they do say, well, who they do say is in the tomb, is very interesting. I think they still refer to it as a prophet, someone who came from another land. So it's as if the oral tradition and that truth has prevailed, although more recently, I think some of them have discarded the belief that it's Jesus.
Uh-huh. I need to recognize we do have some listeners. 105.5 FM on your radio in New Orleans. Thank you for joining us. This is just so fascinating. You know what? So it's an Orthodox. What's wrong with... This is the thing I don't really understand about our society as a whole. If new information comes along, and it might accidentally change our history, why would we want to hide it? Why would we not want to know how it really happened? I guess, I don't know. Maybe I'm just naive. I don't understand. I mean...
You're absolutely
recently,
right. It's something
recently, evolution
that we
see was changed. Happen. The whole theory.
Yep. Yep, it's something that we see again and again, the suppression of particular ideas, the stamping of one particular creed on other people. I mean, we talk about it with Christianity and Catholicism, but it happens in Islam as well, and what you tend to have is people losing sight of the original goals. And
Arif, what do you think they fear? They have to fear something.
I think what it tends to do, here's my theory on it, is what you tend to get is you have one particular, I think it comes down to power and it comes down to control. Essentially, it seems to be that they want to have the power. So often you'll hear in terms of the church will say that, you know, you come to God through Christ, and also you need to come through the church, and there's certain particular ways you would do that. So again, if people were allowed to go directly to the God, to God, for instance, this is one example, then, you know, it's a power thing. That person, you know, the clergy then are put to one side, essentially. And it's a similar thing in the Islamic world as well, the ulama, the imams there as well. It's about keeping that control as, you know, within them. And it becomes very political as well. As soon as the religions grow to a particular size, that tends to happen.
You know what? I agree with you. I really do think it has to do with power and control. Because if you just look at things from a logical standpoint, why do you have to go make a confession to somebody about something you did wrong? You just
exactly.
Pray yourself, you know,
yeah.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, that's just part of it.
Yeah.
Okay, now, let's go to the Tomb of Jesus website.
Mm-hmm.
So where is the Tomb of Jesus? You know, do we have to use the term allegedly, maybe? Allegedly at. It's in Kashmir, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So what makes us think that it's Jesus in the tomb, and how do we know that it's not somebody else? And if it's not somebody else, or if it is somebody else, why don't they just say who it is?
Say who it is, yep. So that's definitely a fair question. So, it's probably worth noting what happened, I'll give you the Ahmadi view. The way the Ahmadis found out about this tomb, or that it entered our creed, was that essentially what happened was and it comes back to the Quran. We'll get onto this probably a bit later, but it comes back to the sort of the Islamic belief on what happened to Jesus essentially at the crucifixion and what happened afterwards. But the founder of the Ahmadiyya community said that he'd received revelation that Jesus, the historical figure of Jesus Christ, had passed away, died a natural death. Now, when he made this announcement, it was like, just as you can imagine, it's heresy to the Christians. However, what I want your listeners to understand is that it's also heresy to the Muslims as well, to the Orthodoxy of Islam. They did not want to hear that Jesus had died. They also believed that he was in heaven somewhere awaiting to return at a particular time. So what happened was this claim was made that he had passed away. And then what happened was that Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad then essentially said to his followers that if that is the case, there must exist a tomb for him somewhere. And then one of his followers mentioned a report that he had sent to him about 15 years previous to this, where he mentioned this particular tomb in Kashmir. And at that time, all that was known about it was that there was this one particular tomb of a figure known as Yus Asaf, and that it was called the Prophet's Tomb, the Rosa Ball, the Prophet's Tomb, and that this person was revered locally, and that he was a prince. He was known as a prince, and that he came from a foreign land, and he taught the religion, and he was a teacher to the Kashmiri people, and that eventually he passed away and he died there. Now, what makes us think that this person might have been Jesus? What's the connection there? Firstly, the name itself, Yus Asaf, is quite similar. Yusu, Yeshua, there's similar sounds, there's similar names. There's other things, though. There's actually claims that there existed inscriptions. There's a Temple of Solomon in Kashmir as well. And there were apparently inscriptions that were photographed that say that this person did claim that he was Jesus later on in his ministry, and claimed to be the same prophet from Israel. But other things we know that he taught in parables. Some of the parables were exactly the same ones Jesus used. But then even then, we could say, well, maybe this was a follower of Christ. You know, Jesus did send out disciples. We know, for instance, St. Thomas was sent to India as well. So couldn't this have been, someone of that nature? What really gets interesting in terms of saying that, this, you know, linking the person to Jesus Christ is actually one feature of the tomb, which on Paul David's film anyway suggests has been recently covered up, and that are these carved footprints. So what other researchers have photographed clearly and shown in the past is that next to this tomb, in this enclosure, there were these footprints that were carved, and other people have said there's nothing unique about foot carvings. They're quite common, but the strange thing about these foot carvings are there's certain marks that are on the feet marked, and it looks as if an artist or someone was trying to preserve some information about who was in this tomb. So on these feet carvings, we have particular scars or marks on each foot in different locations. Now, there was a BBC documentary that covered this that did a wonderful 3D animation of this whole thing, but essentially the theory goes that the marks on these feet carvings are in the correct place if, for instance, the person had undergone a crucifixion. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that is a tantalizing clue, if you like, that suggests that maybe there really is evidence linking this to the person of Jesus. But other evidence is mainly the teachings, the similarity in teachings, the claim that he was Jesus. And also it comes back to a question that why India, which is something that Paul Davidson explores as well. And it turns out that India, or in Afghanistan and that area, there are many lost tribes, or the lost tribes of Israel. Many Israelites are scattered throughout that region. And there were, you know, some, Paul Davidson, I know, described it as a Jewish enclave almost, Kashmir. So there's a strong Jewish presence there. And so if Jesus' mission was to preach to the tribes of Israel, then that area also contained people that he needed to go to and to minister to. So
you know,
those are some of the pieces of evidence, yeah.
Yeah, and that actually makes sense. Well, if I recall, during that time period, the Jews were a really repressed people. So it would make sense that some would branch out and go to other places. Maybe they just wanted to get away from, you know, that type of, I don't know, living under the Romans,
yeah,
and
yeah,
you know, that type of thing. That would make sense.
Yeah, I think it actually dates back to a few centuries before that, in that there was a King Nebuchadnezzar, I believe, is the one,
mm-hmm.
who there was the, you know, the Jews were definitely dispersed at that time due to persecution, and the dispersion carried quite far east. And recently there's even been DNA studies of the people of Kashmir that has shown that, you see, with the Jewish people, they tend to marry within their own race. So that's why it makes sense to almost talk about a Jewish gene, or do DNA tests looking for a Jewish gene. I think they call it the Kohanim test. And so there was actually a researcher in London who produced some research on this, where these lost tribes, some of them were actually tested for this, and it seemed to check out that their stories did seem to check out. But there's so many other similarities between the cultural and linguistic similarities between the people of that part of the world and you know, the Israelites and the Jews. It's quite an interesting, it's that, like I said, again, that's we could have a two-hour program about that.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Another whole interesting area of study as well.
There are many, and you're right. And I do like to learn new things. I also like to learn about just world religions. I do like to know how people think, how they believe, that type of thing. I think it's important, especially where we live in such a global society. Looking again at the tomb of Jesus, why doesn't somebody just go in and get a DNA sample and solve the problem there?
Yep, that would make everyone's life, well, I was going to say easy, but maybe it would make it more difficult.
Well,
or interesting,
it could. I guess it depends on how you look at it.
Yeah, it would.
The
issue, okay,
mm-hmm.
One thing is that this topic, like I was saying earlier as well, the Orthodox Islamic viewpoint on Jesus, let's get into this now a bit, the Orthodox Islamic viewpoint on Jesus is that at the crucifixion, he didn't die on the cross. I'll talk about that a bit more in detail, but then that he was raised up to the heavens. He ascended. This seems to match almost exactly the biblical story of the ascension, which again is, you'll hear Muslims saying that as well. You see, we are in agreement with the Christians on this, so it's even more reason why this is true. So they believe he's up in heaven, and that towards the latter days, in the end of time, Jesus will return and he will herald a new age, and you know, he'll bring people under the banner of Islam. The Christians have the exact opposite view, that again, Jesus will return towards the end of time, and you know, he'll come again, and everyone will unite under Christianity. So it's quite interesting. We talk a lot about the commonalities between religions, and I love to study that, but I really like to get into where they differ as well. It's fascinating. So they both are awaiting Jesus to physically return from the heavens. So as soon as you start talking about a supposed burial or tomb of Jesus, it becomes hugely controversial to the Christians and the Muslims, at least, which, you know, in that area of Kashmir, it's a predominantly Muslim region. So, you know, you have to find someone who's going to support you to dig up this grave and to do this research. So in the film, you would have heard about Suzanne Olsen, who tried doing this, but, you know, she was able to get permission and get to a certain stage, but she was frustrated. And then also there's a German researcher, Holger Kirsten, who's written books on the topic as well, one called Jesus Lived in India. He also tried gaining access, and from what I heard as well, he got to a certain stage and wasn't able to. There's local Kashmiri researchers as well. One, the most prominent one, is a figure known as Dr. Fida Hasnain, who was the head of the state archives of Kashmir for a while. He had real access to the tomb. He's written many books on it. But again, getting actual access to the remains and, you know, getting it is very difficult. Another thing is that if an individual, say, was able to get access and do some sort of test, straight away the credibility of those tests will be questioned. Really, what we need is a, you know, a team of scientists to gain access to there. But the it's just the way it is. The Kashmir is probably one of the most heavily contested and fought over areas in the world today.
Right.
And that's where the tomb is, unfortunately. So just access to the area, access to the tomb, access to the people who have access to the tomb as well, it's just becoming more and more difficult. You might have seen on the film that the right now the tomb anyway is actually pretty much, to most people, it's actually locked. I do know people who have got in and had a look around and taken photos, but it's very hard to get access to it.
Who controls the tomb in Kashmir? I mean, is it the government? Do they have an archaeological society? Is it a particular religion or, you know, that falls under a church or a mosque? Or who's in control of it?
That's another very good question. Tim's currently the caretakers. I think there are a group of four caretakers that are currently in charge of the mosque and looking after the mosque. Now, Suzanne Olsen was able to spend a lot of time there. She interacted with these four individuals and was trying to build a consensus for them to go forward on this. But apparently one out of the four wasn't happy at the last minute and caused a problem. One thing is that the caretakers are definitely Orthodox Muslims in their viewpoint as well. So again, the idea that, you know, you're testing for the remains of Jesus, get their back up, it, you know, they don't like that either. But I have heard that, you know, ultimately, of course, this would come under the state control. So I think the locals who have the influence there are the local caretakers. But the way to probably gain access and to open up the research is to go at the government level. And Suzanne Austin, that's always been at the angle she's been taking, and you know, the way she's trying to open the tomb up is by trying to get as much support and evidence as they can from a government level and then try and go in that way. But it's just very, very difficult. The political tensions in the area as well, you know, make it really very difficult to get access to it.
Well, is it possible, too, that I know Kashmir is a highly disputed place, and we do hear about it in the news quite frequently. I'm not really sure what exactly the problem is, but I know it has to do with Pakistan and India. I don't understand if it's just solely political, if there's something religious involved here, if it's, you know, it's very confusing if you're looking at it from my television.
I mean, basically, it's the countries that, well, India was partitioned into India and Pakistan, and the area of Kashmir, probably due to its natural beauty as well as the sort of strategic location of it, it's always been contested as to which country would gain access to that country, essentially. So, unfortunately, yeah, that most beautiful place and a place that we really need access to is heavily fought over, and it's still, you know, there's a lot of unrest in that particular region. Specifically in that region, actually.
Wow, that's too bad. Now, is there anything from the cultural standpoint that would make them not want to open a tomb? You know, I know over here in the United States, probably in Britain, other places too, if you need to exhume a tomb to prove something, generally it's crime here, but, you know, to prove something, then, you know, you can go through the proper channels and it can be done. But it also occurs to me there could be areas of the world where you never open a grave, no matter what the reason is. Do they have that kind of problem?
Absolutely.
There?
Absolutely. That's a really good question. It was actually brought up by someone during the panel Q&A that we had in Palm Springs, and that is looking at the local sensitivities and the culture. How would they feel about digging up anyone, let alone digging up someone who they revere as a prophet? And interestingly, even in the Ahmadis, when the... So I was talking earlier that we had various successors or khalifas. The fourth khalifa, who was the in charge of our community till about 2003, I remember once he was asked this question about exhuming the tomb. Someone said to him that, look, if we went in there and we dug the tomb up, and, you know, we would be able to solve this mystery and this issue. And he said, can you tell me which Muslim would be ready to go and dig up the grave of Jesus? Because, like you said, even on a human level, although we want to do the research, essentially there's obviously, like you said, there's respect for the dead, and it's hugely contested. I mean, it's same with people trying to do research in Israel as well, when they're looking at the catacombs there and they're looking at tombs there. It's the same issue. We're dealing with a very sensitive issue here. Suzanne Olsen did talk about them allowing her access to maybe one section or maybe the feet or something like that. I don't know what even remains of, you know, we're not really sure what is in the tomb in terms of whether the remains would have lasted the time. I mean, if it really is 2,000 years, that's a lot of time. And then also, like exactly like you said, as soon as you start doing that kind of research, there are people who are going to get upset by that. And the local sensitivities and the cultural ones, like you said in particular, are even more, even additional obstacles that would have to be confronted.
Right,
that was a difficult job, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. It's all order.
Yeah.
Maybe times will change and, you know, that will happen. Now, let's talk about the tomb for a minute. Now, is this a tomb that's set into the ground, or is this a tomb that is on top of the ground?
Okay. My understanding is that the actual tomb and the body are way underground. But what you have is you have an entry at street level that you can go in, and there you can see the sort of the top of it. So what you will often see on photographs and on video will be the sort of the mock buildings that are built just on top, the foundations at the top, whereas the actual body and everything is encased underground, at least one level down below that. So there's like an area for visitors to come in, walk around, say prayers, pay homage, and go out. But the actual tomb, there is an underground tomb, and apparently there's another entrance that gets you straight into that bottom level as well.
Eric, isn't there a way just to simply date the tomb?
That's a really good question. Like, you, I was talking about the feet carvings as well, and one legitimate question that's come up and that I've tried following up on, but we probably need to do more, is just, has someone tried to date those footprints? Because if even those feet carving, even if any part of the tomb can be dated back to 2,000 years, that suddenly makes the whole topic a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not aware whether those actual studies have been done on just dating elements around the tomb. So I fully agree with you, there's a lot more that needs to be done, and that's one obvious thing to try and do, is that.
Okay, how about the building that's over the tomb? Do we know how old the building is?
I think the thing is that the building's been renovated and rebuilt and changed quite a lot. So it's hard to pick up from that point of view in terms of what, you know, the actual timber around it as well might well be more recent, but that's because bits have been repaired and rebuilt.
Right. I have another question from the virtual auditorium. If one could get access to the tomb and gather samples of tissue or other items, how would you test them to prove that it is the tomb of Jesus? First part. What kind of test would you do? Second part. If you do DNA tests, how would that prove that it's Jesus?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there is a second part to this story, which is that, and in fact, I think this is one of the places where Edward T. Martin came across this theory in the first place, and he likes telling the story about a beer called Murray Beer. And what happened there was he basically found out about, there's a town in Pakistan, North Pakistan, called Murray, M-U-R-E-E. And that is basically, he found out, he tells the story well, he found out that that was named after a lady called Mary, and that there's actually, and that was Jesus's mother apparently, and there's actually a tomb in Pakistan called, that's supposedly Mary's tomb. So one possibility, and this is something Suzanne Olsen tried really hard to do, and she's probably spent, I think she spent more time working on the project at Murray than she might have done in Kashmir. She certainly spent a lot of time there. But her angle was to try and get the DNA from both of those tombs and try and see if we can prove whether they were mother and son. Now, that's one fascinating area. Mm-hmm. The other interesting area would be something that wasn't talked about on Paul David's film, and that is the Shroud of Turin. Now, here we go again. There's another topic, remember, that we could have a two-hour program
about.
You're
going to open all the candles.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so
again, that's another thing where we can't get more access to it, we can't really test. So there was a big fuss about it being a forgery and that carbon dating had proved that. However, in 2005, there was some research showing that actually it is much more likely that there was a fault made during the dating. But there is blood on the Shroud of Turin, and I do know DNA has been extracted. So I'm no expert on the DNA testing here. And also, over periods of time, the samples can deteriorate to really badly, and it all depends on the condition they're stored in. But there's some tantalizing possibilities there of possibly checking the DNA against the shroud, but that's like a whole, that's like a dream. if we were to one day get there, that would certainly help. But yeah, that's way far off. But even if you were to analyze the DNA, you could probably try and work out the origin of the person, at least. If you could maybe show that this was someone from Israelite, again, it would be another piece of the puzzle. But you're right, it's not like the DNA would end the whole issue and that would be that. In fact, the original author of the website, Abu Bakr, who I mentioned before, he's someone who definitely feels that we're overplaying the DNA, we're focusing too much on the DNA, and that if you gain more evidence about the oral linguistics, the oral traditions, linguistic similarities, and you compile a bigger case, that will help the theory more than trying to go for the DNA evidence.
And that's really a good point, because we have in the past been able to show population migrations based on oral traditions, linguistics, just the way people communicate. You know, you had spoken that Jesus taught in parables. We all know that. And in this particular region, people there have teachings that were related that were done in parables.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's other things to look at. But I can see, because basically what you want to do is change history.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody is going to want empirical evidence.
Yep.
And so that's why you would almost have to be able to go to some of these other venues, you know, some DNA testing, carbon dating, this type of thing, in order to rewrite the history books.
Absolutely. But some might say, well, look, the fact that this, I mean, if this theory is true and that, you know, we've had 2,000 years where the belief has, you know, been incorrect, it's interesting how right now in history we have all the various tools we could probably need to do some of these tests, so maybe now is the time when things will open up and, you know, we will know the truth.
And that could be, because it really has only been fairly recently, you know, looking at human history, that we would have the technologies that we could actually perform these types of tests. Eric, we're coming up on the top of the hour break. I'd like you to have an opportunity to tell the listening audience where your website is and any other websites that you're associated with that you'd like them to know about.
Yeah, sure. I think the easiest thing is if I give them my personal website, from there they can get information on the Ahmadiyya community, they can go to the Team of Jesus site, they can go to the Paul David site as well. So my personal website is just my name, arifkhan.co.uk. So that's arifkhan.co.uk, and from there there's links to the other bits and pieces, and you can access my personal blog or send me an email from there as well.
Okay. You know, the other thing I really like talking about you, Eric, or talking to you, not about you, is your energy. You have a passion for this subject, and it really shows in your communication. And those are the types of people I'm willing to listen to more seriously. You know, you got somebody who's talking about a subject, they're just kind of, you know, well, you know, this is who I am, this is what I'm about, and it's kind of this monotone, but you can really hear the energy, the excitement, the how committed you are to this.
Well, I'm glad that's coming across at 3 a.m. hour of my time as well, so that's good.
Yes, I should bring that up, everybody. Arif did crawl out of bed at a very early hour to be on this program, and I really do appreciate it, because I do know that's tough. Anyways, we are at the top of the hour, and you're listening to Voice of the People on the Paranormal Radio Network, and we will be right back.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to tonight's live global broadcast on Voice of the People. We have some listeners down in the New Orleans area. You're listening to 105.5 FM on your radio, along with many people worldwide on different internet venues. There's so many, I couldn't even name them all anymore. There's also a way to listen on your cell phone. You can take us on the go. Just dial 704-631-4060 and enter your four-digit station ID code, which is 2899. Tonight my guest is Arif Khan. He is a researcher and writer, and we have been discussing quite a few things, most of it related to Jesus in India theory. Arif, the one thing I wanted to absolutely bring up was the crucifixion.
Yep.
Because for the Jesus in India theory to work, Jesus would have had to survive the crucifixion or never even been crucified to begin with. I guess that's a possibility too. But, historically, that is the belief I believe in both the Muslim community and the Christian community. But you have some evidence that suggests that maybe he actually survived the crucifixion.
Yeah, it's interesting. This theory seems to come up even more and more. I mean, those people who are familiar with the Da Vinci Code, that how it was based on the Bloodline books as well, I think they talk about the idea of Jesus surviving the crucifixion. It's mentioned the Ahmadi faith from the Islamic point of view talk about it, and there's some Christian authors as well who have mentioned it. There's one called Hugh Sconfield, who's an author who's written a book called The Passover Plot, in which he again presents this case. And I have to say, I think it's one of my favorite topics to talk about because it is very interesting. And I don't know, I've always liked puzzles, and this is surely one of the greatest puzzles. And what's really interesting is that so many of the clues are right there in the Gospels, they're in the Bible right there, and there's many things that are unexplained as well. So yeah, let's get straight into this. So, first of all, why is it important what happened at the crucifixion? It's actually, if you look at where Islam, Christianity, and Judaism divide, you can pretty much pinpoint the crucifixion, because from a Jewish point of view, they claim that he was a failed Messiah. They said, yes, Jesus came along, he made some claims, but essentially we put him to death, and if he was the right, true one, that wouldn't have happened. Muslims, interestingly, the tradition there is, I'll get into this after I go through the biblical evidence, but there's one verse in the Quran that says that the Jews claimed that they killed Jesus, but they didn't kill him. And also the Islamic view is that for a true prophet, God would have intervened and God would have saved him. Christians take the other angle. The Orthodox Christian view is that, no, Jesus died on the cross. Not only that, but the key reason for his advent, one of the main purposes of his advent, was to die on the cross for our sins. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think you lose a lot of the other important aspects of Jesus. So it was taken to its extreme, if you like, in Mel Gibson's film The Passion, which focused so much on what went on during that time, and so much on the suffering and death on the cross, that to me it felt as if it detracted from the message of Jesus and ended up focusing far too heavily on this thing. So the crucifixion is a key area. What I'll do is I'll run through the evidence of those who argue that he survived the crucifixion. And actually, it starts with, if you like, how you view Jesus. I mean, if you view Jesus as the Son of God who came to die for the sins, then he's unique. But if you view Jesus as this doesn't detract from him, but if you view him as a prophet, and a very special prophet, and the Messiah sent for a specific mission, and if you view him as a prophet like other prophets, such as Moses, Moses, Abraham, Isaac, or these other people, if you view it in that way, in Jonah, for instance, then you see that the pattern tends to be a prophet comes, he makes the claim that, you are sinners, you should need to repent, you need to change this, you should do this. They set the example. What typically happens is that the people pretty often rebel against that person. There are attempts made on his life, but throughout, the prophet is saved, and God comes down and helps him in different ways, and he's able to carry on. So if you view the trial of the crucifixion in that sense, that this was a punishment, this was a source of great danger for Jesus, but that God saved him, then it, again, as an initial point, that makes some sense. But if we look at what really happened, so let's get into the Garden of Gethsemane. So you've got in the Bible, you've got the crucifixion story, you've got Jesus, he knows he's going to be arrested, and he's with his followers in Gethsemane, the disciples. And there he's said to be praying fervently, so hard that he said that he was actually sweating blood. So he's really praying, and he's waking his disciples up saying, come pray. And the prayer he says that, Father, please remove this cup from me. Now, people often take that to mean that he was saying that, this trial's coming up, please save me from it. But then he adds the caveat that not because it's my will, but that it's thy will. And that essentially is, one aspect of any prophet is that they will always bow down to whatever God's will is. When Abraham was asked to sacrifice his son, he went as far as, you know, he was prepared to do it, but he obviously stopped at the final stage. But he was prepared to, same here, Jesus is saying, you know, if you want me to go through this, if that's your will, then, you know, so be it. But if it's your will to save me, please save me. So that's the first piece. And then also, I mean, sometimes I've read or I've spoken to Christians about this piece, and I said, look, if Jesus' mission was to come and die, why was he praying for this? And the answer I've been told is, well, he had a human aspect, and this was, you know, he was showing his, you know, sort of human nature, and he was naturally afraid of death. Whereas all the prophets I've read about, they don't, you know, when there's in danger, they'll pray for their survival, and, you know, but they will always have full faith in, you know, God will prevail. So to me, it sounds like, you know, Jesus was literally saying to God, you know, I have unfinished business. There's things that need to be done. Please save me from this, if that's your will, as, you know, as his heavenly Father. So there was the prayer in Gethsemane. Then also, when we're actually at the stage where Jesus is brought before Pilate, there's another piece of the puzzle in that Pilate's wife actually says that have nothing to do with this man because I have seen a terrible dream. Now, one thing I should say is, when we're reading the story about, you know, exactly who condemned Jesus to death, whether it was the Romans, whether the Jews had more of an influence, it does get a bit political. We can't fully trust that this is exactly how the story went. But it's interesting that Pilate's wife did say, don't have anything to do with him because I've seen a dream. Now, I know you're into dreams, actually, November. But the idea of dreams is something that goes throughout the religious scripture. And often dreams are a way that God has used in the past to send messages to people. So maybe this was another one that, you know, Pilate's wife was sent this dream. Now, also, the crucifixion, as we know, took place on a Friday. And what's interesting about that is the following day was the Sabbath. And the rule is that, the Jewish rule was that there was no body to be left on the cross at the Sabbath. So just by the very timing of the crucifixion, it's timed in such a way that it would be very short. Now, another thing to point out is that often when someone hears crucifixion, the first thing they think about, or the only thing they think about, is Jesus' crucifixion, because that's what we know about and that's what we're taught about. But throughout history, the crucifixion was used, but you can see that it tends to be a much longer punishment. The idea is that it's a drawn-out long punishment. Often it would last for several days. And also the idea is that it's a very visual thing. It's like, you know, that the body is presented in public to put people off doing anything similar. You know, if you want to rebel against the Roman government here, this is what will happen. So crucifixion tended to last several days. Now, there's one important reference, which is the Jewish historian that we mentioned earlier, Josephus. He actually talks about a friend of his who survived a crucifixion. He said that he went to a particular village, and then when he returned home, he found three people were being crucified, and one of them was a friend of his. So he went to the local, to the ruler of the time and said, you know, this is a friend of mine, please take him down. So what happened was that apparently the three were taken down, and, you know, two of them did die, but the third one did survive after he was given medical attention. So we associate crucifixion automatically with death, whereas it is possible, and there's historical evidence from the first century of another crucifixion that took place where, you know, the person did survive, even after several days. Whereas with Jesus as well, another thing is that although the timing varies in the Gospels, some say he went on the third hour, some say the sixth hour, but it tends to, I mean, what it suggests is the crucifixion was either about 3 hours or about 6 hours long, which in the grand scheme of things is quite a short period of time. And then also, again, while I was talking about these various clues we have, one clue is that something was given to Jesus on a sponge, and it's right there in the Gospel again that they were able to give him a sponge after he said he thirsted. And immediately after this, he says, it is finished, and, you know, he stops breathing. Some researchers have suggested that maybe there was something on the spines to drug him or to sedate him. That's a possibility as well.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting one because there's no real explanation given as to what that substance was or why it was even given to him.
Okay.
So we've got the... now, here's another key one, and that is that his legs were not broken. So what tends to happen was to speed up crucifixions, they would break the legs. Now, in our case, with Jesus, it's on the Friday, the Sabbath's coming, the bodies need to be taken down. So the two that were crucified alongside him, their legs were broken. But when they came to Jesus, they said, you know, he's stopped breathing, he's already dead, his legs haven't been broken. So if we go back to what I was saying before about prophets being saved, you know, God helping them, this to me is like a sign where he's given that opportunity. He appears to be dead. They think he's dead. And so his legs are not broken, allowing him to actually survive. You know, that crucial point where if the legs were broken, that would be the end of the story. But
right.
They weren't. And then again, what happened following this? I mean, what happened to Jesus' body? And why? So we find that Joseph of Arimathea. Now, question arises, well, who was he in the first place? Because we are taught that Jesus had these 12 disciples. So if they were his closest followers, where were they at this particular time? Who was Joseph of Arimathea? Next, we have the mention of Nicodemus again, who's described as secret followers of Jesus. Where did these people come from? And how come we've not heard about them before? That's another interesting element in the whole story. And what happens is Joseph goes and asks Pilate for the body. And again, do you know what Pilate's response was? Pilate's response was, you know, he's dead already. And, you know, he was actually surprised that it had happened so quickly. And then again, the tomb. So here's another piece. Where does Jesus' body go next? It goes to a tomb. Who does the tomb belong to? Oh, it belonged to Joseph of Arimathea. Again, who was Joseph of Arimathea if he was able to get access to Jesus' tomb, to Jesus' body immediately after the crucifixion? What we get, there's a sense that there's something else going on here. Now, 2,000 years after the event, it's very difficult for us to time, you know, decode what was really going on, but there's definitely something that seems to be a bit strange about this whole thing. And it gets stranger because also what the Gospel of John mentions is that there was 100 pounds in weight of aloes and myrrh that were taken to the body of Jesus. So I don't know if you've come across this before, but often it's said that this was to embalm the body. Actually, interestingly, what the Gospel says is that these herbs were taken because that was a Jewish burial practice. When actually, Jewish burial practice, and it's still the same today, it's just you would wash the body and you would wrap it in a cloth. There's none of this anointing with herbs. Also, and again, like I said, this is in the Bible, the name of the herbs are given directly. There's aloe and myrrh. And on my website, you can see an article on this. But even recently, in the BBC, they had a newspaper article about the role of aloe in healing. And there was actually an article saying that an experiment, the aloe was given to mice, and it showed that mice who had lost a lot of blood were able to still stay alive by taking some of this aloe. So there's some interesting healing properties with aloe and myrrh. Some people have said, well, yeah, okay, it's not to do with Jewish burial practices, but actually it was to fragrance the body. But, you know, they happened to pick these two herbs, which seem to have very strong medicinal purposes, properties, I should say. And then also, we'll get onto this a little bit later, but the Ahmadi, the founder of the Ahmadiyya community, he has Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, when he was writing and doing his research on this topic, he actually wrote a book, I should say, that was called Jesus in India, the same title as Paul David's film, and he wrote this book here. About 1900. In that book, he has a section dedicated to the aloe and myrrh, and he says that there's references in medical books that talk about a ointment of Jesus, and the story goes that the medical books say that this is the ointment that was given to Jesus to help heal his wounds, and the aloe and myrrh are two key ingredients of that mixture. So what it could be is that when Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were taking these herbs to the body of Jesus, they were actually trying to nurse him back to life. One more thing on this. So what happens? We've got Friday, the crucifixion takes place. We've got Saturday. What happened on Saturday? Well, Saturday was the Sabbath. So, you know, the Jews would have stayed at home. There would have been no one around anywhere. And then on Sunday is when we witness the resurrection, or when the Mary's, depending on the accounts you take in the Gospels, is when Jesus is seen alive again. Now, there's like an assumption that nothing took place on Saturday, whereas, you know, because it was the Sabbath. Whereas, you know, if Joseph of Arimathea had Jesus in his own tomb that he himself owned, you know, there's absolutely, he could easily gain access to that tomb, and he could, you know, they could help nurse Jesus back to life. Now, one objection that is raised is that no way that couldn't have happened. Why? Because there was a Roman guard placed in front of the tomb. How do we know that? First of all, even that's a bit sketchy, but interestingly, why was the guard placed there? And it's like, well, some of the Jews said that, you know, this talk about Jesus and that he might return from the dead or whatever. We want to make sure that, you know, nothing like that happens. We want a guard there. So that guard was placed there to appease the Jews, essentially. But there's no real evidence that, you know, the Jews wouldn't have been around on Saturday because it was the day of the Sabbath. So there's no evidence that that guard was maintained there throughout, or even that there even was one. We hear about it, but, you know, there might not have been one. Also, on Sunday, like some people say, there's no access to the tomb. Well, why were the two Marys going to the tomb in the first place on the Sunday? And we're told that they were going to anoint the body. So if they were going to anoint the body, obviously they would have to have been able to get into the tomb. So there has to be a means of access to the tomb. So, but again, like I was saying, it's like there's little hints of evidence here and there. The biggest piece of evidence about Jesus surviving the crucifixion is that he's seen again after the crucifixion. I can't put it more plainly than that. And I want to pick up on just three things he said. Again, this is in the Gospels. This is not coming from any other source. It's coming from the Gospels. When he first sees Mary, she recognizes that he's not the gardener, he's Jesus. She goes to embrace him, and he says, "Do not touch me." Now, it's quite interesting because often we take a very, you know, we're thinking about a resurrected body. We're thinking about, you know, he's half spirit, half man, maybe. But sometimes we ignore the really obvious thing right in front of us. If he's just gone through this and he's got all these wounds, etc., and he's healing, he's going to say, "Don't touch me," because obviously it could definitely hurt him. Secondly, when he does come amongst the disciples, one of the first things he says to them is, "Do you have something to eat?" And he actually eats in front of them. And it's almost as if he's going at pains to show that, look, I'm really flesh and bones. I'm a real person. And he even says that. And he even says to them to come and touch his wounds. And the third thing he says, "Why are you afraid?" Because when they first see him, they are afraid. And he said, you know, "Come and touch me and feel that, you can feel that I'm bone and flesh." And we're told that doubting Thomas said, you know, "I won't believe it until I can touch his actual wounds." And he, you know, Jesus presents himself and says, "Yeah, you can touch me, feel my wounds." So we've got these very vivid accounts. And then also, I mean, this kind of relates slightly to the question we had earlier about whether Jesus existed. But we know that the Christian community was inspired by Jesus around that time. And we know that it survived till today. So for that to have happened, there must have been something pretty incredible that took place there. So for the resurrection, because there's some scholars who dismiss a lot of this, for the resurrection to, and say, you know, the resurrection didn't take place, the resurrection post-crucifixion sightings were forged. Well, what Christian scholars often say back is, well, then look at Christianity, look at the way it spread, something amazing obviously took place. So what I would say is, yes, something amazing did take place. They did see Jesus after the crucifixion, but we don't have to believe that he was, you know, physically resurrected.
It doesn't have to be something magical.
Exactly. Now, some people might say, well, it's such a subtle point. What difference does it make? But you'll be surprised how, you know, there's a real difference between whether he survived and you know, whether he was fully died and resurrected, but purely from a sort of theological point of view, to the point where, you know, St. Paul says that if Christ hadn't died for our sins and, you know, wasn't resurrected, our faith is in vain. So if you take a very, very dogmatic approach to some of these things, you know, you can... There are people who will fight tooth and nail and say, no, he definitely died. The theory he survived is not true. Whereas if you speak to a lot of people, they say, well, do you know what? That actually makes a lot of sense. And you know what? Previously, when I've looked on the record of the crucifixion and resurrection, I thought it's a bit supernatural and I've dismissed it. But this idea actually gains a lot of, you know, gives it a lot more credibility and it seems to make a lot of sense.
You know, I think, Eric, with a lot of other things, I think it's fear that... You know, what you're presenting, people are thinking, oh, blasphemy.
Exactly.
Maybe some are, maybe some aren't, or whatever. Yeah. But maybe they're afraid that it would take away from who Jesus was. Why would it do that? This man was incredible, absolutely incredible. He had such wonderful answers for people to get along with each other, for society to work, you know, those types of things. Why would changing the way the history was written as far as whether he survived the crucifixion or not or was buried in India or not, why should that have to change anything?
Yep, I fully agree with you. In fact, it's almost, it'll make him a greater man because he's gone through this great ordeal and come out the other side and, you know, won against the odds. So without a miraculous sort of, intervention. So it's a real testimony. In fact, it's probably the biggest miracle that he has shown was, this, in fact, I should have mentioned as well, one of the other things is he does talk about that the one sign I will give to this generation is the sign of Jonah. And he talks about how Jonah, prophet Jonah, so the story goes, was swallowed by a whale and lived in a well for 3 days, 3 nights, prayed to be saved, and then the whale eventually sicked him up and he was there. We don't need to worry too much about whether that was true or not, but that was what Jesus was drawing the parallel with. So, and he said, as Jonah was in the belly of the whale, I will be in the belly of the earth. So again, this matches this same idea that I'm trying to get across, that Jesus was a prophet, and that he was also, you know, in the same line as with other prophets. There were miracles shown at his hand, and that he was saved miraculously, and it was God showing his favor on, you know, one of his chosen prophets and helping him survive this ordeal.
Right. Now, I knew this question was going to come up. What about the sword, the piercing of Jesus?
Oh, yes, very good point. Yeah, because a lot of the time, the people who rebut this argument just mention the spear in the side, and they think, you know, end of story. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Okay, so what we know about was that a pierced wound was made in the side of Jesus. Now, I'll give you all sides of the argument here. So there's some who say that wound killed him, and, you know, no one could have survived this piercing. That's mainly the Christian viewpoint. There's some, I mentioned Holger Kirsten, a German scholar previously. He goes back to the actual Greek word used to describe that thrust by the sword, and he says that rather than it being... He seems to say that it's quite a light, superficial wound, and that the word suggests that. And his argument is that rather than it being a way to make sure Jesus was dead, it was more like a test to see whether he was still alive or not. So he said that, you know, if you were trying to kill someone, make sure they were dead, you would just spear them from the front in the heart. But by poking someone in the side, if you like, it was a test to see whether Jesus was still alive or not. Now, what's interesting is that when he was pierced, blood and water flowed out. But again, see... Those who support the idea of him surviving say, well, that's proof he survived. And then I also hear others saying, well, that's proof he died. So those who say it's proof he survived say that the fact that the blood and water came out or gushed out, flowed out, even at a time when Jesus was supposed to have died, shows that the heart was still active and that blood was still flowing around his body. If he had been dead for a while, or if he had died, you know, there would be the blood, the heart would not be active, and also the pressure wouldn't be there. So there's some who argue that, and I've heard medical people argue that opinion. Even on the Jesus in India film, there's a medical person who argues that. But you will also get medical people who will say, no, the fact that there's blood and water present means that the blood has started to separate, and this is a sign after death. So it tends to be the medical people who have a Islamic viewpoint or one particular viewpoint anyway will support one theory, and the others will support the other. So, yeah, you can make of it what you want. So, yeah, that thrust. There is a suggestion that it was a light, superficial wound, but again, it's you know, it's hard to tell. But we cannot say that it would have definitely killed Jesus completely. There is still, even with that spearing, he still could have survived that.
Well, does it even say that they thrust it into him? Maybe they just poked him.
Yeah, I think, exactly.
I suppose if blood and water came out, then there would have had to have been some type of wound.
Yeah, it would have had to punch the skin. But I've read one thesis saying that. That would have helped Jesus survive because they say it would have reached his lung, and that there would have been a build-up of this liquid in the lymph in his lung, and that by this poke actually helped drain that out and helped him survive. So there's a lot of competing theories, but one of the big things is that, you know, we're talking about events that took place so long ago. And interestingly, November, one thing is that the gospel that presents the most detailed analysis of the crucifixion. And it's even the gospel that I'm relying on here when I talk about the aloe and myrrh, and when we're talking about the blood and water. That is actually the gospel of John, which most scholars think is probably the latest one as well. So, you know, it's we can only rely on this evidence so much. We can only do with what we've got the sources in front of us. But, yeah, it's a tricky one.
Well, the blood and water one, I have actually seen somebody who's had a tube inserted into their lungs to drain... to drain fluid off of it, and it does look like, well, blood and water.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I would probably cite on something like this, too, is the survival of a crucifixion. You know, back in the old days in Britain, they used to tie strings to people's toes when they buried them and then thread them up to the ground and put a bell on them. This is how we got the graveyard shift. And then people would roam the cemeteries, paid people, I would imagine, and listen for bells, because if a bell was ringing, they dig them back up,
exactly.
Because you know what? Maybe they weren't dead. And there's also this really cool book. It's called Zombies in History. I know it's kind of a strange title, but it's actually a historical book about the idea of zombies. And it is these types of cases where somebody was thought to have been dead, and they weren't actually dead. You know, they're found walking around town, you know, two, three days later. You know, these were generally in places where they didn't bury people 6 feet underneath the ground, that type of thing. They just had their, you know, whatever it was. It could have been a scaffold, could have been a tomb, something like that. And they just kind of come out thinking, you know, what's going on here?
Exactly. And you're talking recent history. You're talking 200-300 years previously.
Right.
So 2,000 years ago, are you telling me that, you know, we had a better sense of knowing when someone was dead or not then? If these things even happen today with all our modern medicine, then of course such an event could have happened previously.
Right. So it's not like you're presenting something that is so outlandish and
exactly.
So unbelievable that it couldn't absolutely be possible, because obviously it could. There are many, like you said, even today. They've carted people off to the morgue, and their foot starts shaking, and it's like, what? This person is not dead. You know, that's happened in our modern medicine.
I'd just like to, if possible, get into the Islamic angle on this. So
yes,
it's very fascinating, because we've got this debate in Christianity about whether he died on the cross or not. There's a different but very fascinating debate in Islam. Now, so just a quick overview. So in terms of the, because I've heard some people come up to me saying, why are you reading a book on Jesus? You're a Muslim, aren't you? And I said, yes. They said, you believe in Jesus? And we said, yes, we accept him as a prophet. And I'm, oh, okay, we didn't know that. So that's the first thing. Yeah, the Muslims do believe in Jesus as a Messiah, but they believe that his mission was for the lost sheep of Israel, that he was sent to the Jews as their Messiah, and that he was. One thing that is very clearly stressed in throughout the Quran is that we don't accept that he was the son of God. We accept him as a special person, but that sonship is rebutted, if you like, quite strongly in the Quran. That's the major difference. But what is interesting is what it says about the crucifixion. Now, it's quite a strange one, because even with Christianity, this debate has gone on for so many hundreds of years. And, you know, with the Quran, there was probably it's interesting, even the words used there have been debated so often. There's one verse dealing with the crucifixion that I'd just like to read out, actually. It's from the fourth chapter. And basically, it's the context of this verse is, it's talking about the Israelites, the Jews, and there's a section here that says, and I quote, and they're saying, we killed Jesus the Messiah, whereas they killed him not, nor crucified him, but he was made to appear that way. Now, I'm just going to stop there, because over the last few hundred years, the interpretation of this has predominantly been that Jesus, and you'll hear this again and again in Muslim circles, that the Quran says Jesus didn't die on the cross. Yep, I agree. But they often say, no, what the Quran says is that Jesus was never placed on the cross. Someone else was placed on the cross and made to appear like him. Now, this sounds quite far-fetched, but it's an interpretation that you'll hear again and again. So, and all they're basing that on is the line that says that, you know, they didn't crucify him. It was made to appear this way. And again, this gets into linguistics and the Arabic words, but essentially the Arabic word used, shubiya lahum, means that was how it was made to appear. It was made to look that way. So one interpretation has been that means it was made to look like Jesus was on the cross, but it wasn't Jesus on the cross. But now, if we come back to what we've just been discussing about survival of the crucifixion, well, how about that we interpret that saying it was made to appear like he was dead, but he didn't actually die? That would still fit this verse, and it's one, again, I was talking about pieces of a jigsaw, but it's when these two traditions, if we can fit them together, which they seem to fit so nicely with this survival thesis, it's something really nice. I'm not saying we believe it just because it means we can reconcile these two accounts, but it does seem to bring everything together nicely. And I'll just read on. The next section in the Quran says, those who differ therein are in a state of doubt about it. They have no definite knowledge, but only follow a conjecture, and they do not convert this conjecture into a certainty. So again, the Quran saying that, you know, people are in doubt and, you know, we're not quite sure. And that seems to be exactly the state that we're at now. So one thing about the survival is that it can be argued both from the Quranic account, which say, you know, the Muslims will agree on, and then also the Christian biblical account as well seems to present almost the same view.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, that one.
It really is.
Before I forget, I just want to say this particular verse of the Quran, the one that follows says, regarding the crucifixion, on the contrary, Allah exalted him to himself, or God raised Jesus. Now, again, the Arabic word tends to be that God raised his status, meaning he saved him from an ignominious death on the cross and, you know, was able to save him. But this idea is prevalent in the Muslim world that Jesus wasn't put on the cross, someone else would, and secondly, God raised him up to the heavens. So on the Paul David's film, when you see the locals saying that, you know, what you're saying that Jesus in this tomb is an insult to the Quran. This is what they mean. They're saying that the Quran says God lifted Jesus, so this can't be Jesus in that tomb. Just wanted to make that point.
Arif, can I ask a tough question?
Sure.
We have the Bible and we have the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that somewhere in history we decided to, that's when history began. But we do have older texts. We have the Vedic text. We have the Sumerian text. There's another one. I can't think of it off the top of my head. Why do we so readily just discount those outright and believe that history began with just the Bible and the Quran?
That's really interesting. I mean, one thing worth mentioning is that the Quran, I mean, often you'll see a new religion will come along and it will disregard or ignore the previous one. Now, I'll give you a perfect example. What do we, the prophecies about Jesus and everything, and the previous Israelite prophets are in a body of books that we have in our Bible today. What do we call that section? We call it the Old Testament, right?
Right.
So because there's a New Testament now, perfect example. So as soon as a New Testament comes, the previous one is the Old Testament. So that's something that happens so often. But one thing to note is that, again, the followers of Islam and the Muslims tend to not really pay much attention to the other faiths, but the actual message in the Quran talks specifically about, it talks about the Jews and it talks about the Christians by name, and it also talks about those others who follow God as well. And it doesn't just dismiss their text. In fact, it says it refers to them as the people of the book. The Jews, the Israelites, and also the Christians are referred to, and the Muslims are collective term, the people of the book. And then also, even the Quran talks about other people. You know, it talks about the Sabians, and it talks about other groups as well. And it just basically says anyone who fears God, or is, you know, anyone who worships God and is true, there is knowledge in these other faiths as well, and the validity of those faiths is stressed in the Quran. But sadly, you don't really hear about that, and not just. You don't hear about that by commentators talking about Islam. You don't hear about that from the Muslims themselves, even though it's right there in the scriptures.
Interesting. Do you think that maybe religions at some point in history just kind of picked and chose, not eliminating things from the book, but the things to focus on because it dealt with their agenda?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at the way the books that we even have today were formed, like, you'll see there are so many... How many Gospels existed, how many, you know, writings from the Christian body of texts existed before we got the canonized Bible today? Again, that's a two-hour program, because the formation of the canon, the formation of the four Gospels, which Gospels made it, which Gospels didn't, working out what was creed, what wasn't, suddenly one particular, book, one day you'll be reading from it, the next, at that time, it would be declared heretical, or copies of it would be burnt. You know, this happens throughout history. We do see this. We see people with a particular agenda, you form that canon. You say, yep, this is what I want to keep in, this is what I don't want to keep in. It's a shame that happens.
Yes, it is. Arif, there are so many different directions we could go, and guess what? We're quickly closing here. The second coming of Jesus.
Yep.
What does that mean? And who is Mirza? I'm going to let you say his
name. Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, right. Okay, so, there is a tradition that Jesus will return, and it's a tradition that we find both in the biblical text and in the Islamic text. So in the sayings of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, he has certain sayings that we call hadith, where he talked about the time when Jesus will return, and he uses the word Isa ibn Maryam, meaning Jesus son of Mary. So again and again he says Jesus son of Mary will come down, he will do this, he will do that. So there are traditions, and as I was saying at the top of the program, there's traditions in other faiths as well that someone is going to come. Some people talk about Zarathustra, Buddha. Christian and Islamic viewpoints say Jesus. Christian viewpoints say that Jesus will come and herald, the kingdom of earth and the kingdom of heaven on earth, and, it will be a Christian time. Muslims believe he's going to come down as a Muslim. So, these both can't both be right. And a lot of people believe that, towards the end of time, or towards the latter days, they say, there will be a prophet or someone will come. So Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, the founder of the Ahmadiyya movement, said that through divine revelation, he had been told that these people were going to come down instead of separate ones to the separate people. One person was going to come down with the mission to bring everyone together. And that was his claim, which, like I said, is a massive claim. Now, he also, later on in his life, after a couple of years, said that he had been told that the original Jesus had passed away and that what was meant by the second coming was his advent. Now, it should be made clear, he wasn't saying that he was the reincarnation of Jesus. What he was saying was that the mission that had been outlined, you know, especially in the Islamic tradition, the mission to bring the Muslims back to the true teachings, that mission was something he fulfilled. And one thing which is quite interesting that he, you know, alluded to was what we know about John the Baptist. So this goes back to Jesus himself. So even to this day, some Jews will say that, no, we can't accept Jesus as the Messiah because there is a prophecy that before Jesus comes, Elijah will return. So Elijah was one of the Jewish prophets, Israelite prophets, and there was a tradition that he will return. So there's a passage in the Gospel where someone asks Jesus, well, you know, what about Elijah? Wasn't Elijah to return? And Jesus turns to them and says that, you know, you will probably not believe this or understand this, but I tell you that John the Baptist is the Elijah that was prophesied to come. So what he's saying here is that the you know, that prophecy about someone else returning was not necessarily the exact same person, but it was someone else coming with a similar mission or with similar characteristics that was, you know, to fulfill this mission. So that is one interpretation, one possible meaning of what the, you know, the second coming might mean. Again, it's a huge topic, but that's one interpretation. So the Ahmadiyya community say that, you know, this idea of prophets returning or people coming back, you know, one, their belief is that it was fulfilled in this person, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad. That Mirza Ghulam Ahmad was, that was his mission. And by establishing this community within Islam, this is his idea to try and bring peace and to bring people together. And that, you know, that was what his mission is, and that's what the community's main mission is now.
Sarah, do you think we're in a end times society?
That's another 2-hour program, November.
I'll tell you what, you can just take up all of next year, huh?
Yeah, when I start looking at prophecies, I find it really interesting how the Islamic prophecies and sort of Christian Judaic prophecies seem to match a lot in terms of what the end times will be, and a lot of the signs we see right in front of us today. In the Islamic tradition in particular, there's loads of references about certain things we'll see. Let me give you one example, and this is about Jesus talks about when he will return and the second coming. He actually gives a reference to an eclipse. He says that, you know, when the Son of Man will return, there will be... I'm paraphrasing slightly, but he also says that the moon is eclipsed. There will be a sun and a moon eclipse would take place. I think it's from Mark. So he talks about the moon will be eclipsed and the sun will not give its light. Now, what we have here, interestingly, is that... now, he's actually talking about just before the Day of Judgment that this is a sign that will be shown. There's a Quranic reference that literally says almost the same thing, that the moon is eclipsed and the sun and the moon will be fused together. And then there's also hadith which were sayings of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, saying that that there will be a sign for, you know, when the Prophet will come towards the end of time for the Muslims. There'll be a sign, and that sign will be that he gives a bit more detail. He says on this particular night, so the Muslims have a month called Ramadan, which is when they fast. So he said during the month of Ramadan, which is 30 days, the eclipse of the sun will take place on such and such day, and the moon will take place on another particular day. And he said specifically which days it would happen. And he said this would be a sign of, the Messiah having arrived. And it's fascinating how you see the same signs mentioned in these same places. And then also, you know, Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad made his claim in 1889, and I think it was 1894, about 5 years later, these eclipses were seen and took place. So are we living in towards the end of time? Yeah, quite possibly. I think we are. There's... a lot of religious things point to this as well, but if you really want to scare yourself, you should read about peak oil and our our dependence on some finite resources that we have on this earth and the way that mankind is basically pillaging and getting way beyond its means. And you know, it's a pretty scary thing. And then also, if you add to that thoughts about a third world war and, you know, the way we've got nuclear technology right now, if you read about biblical and Quranic talk about the end of days, some of the, you know, the explosions and sights you will see like you've never seen before. Unfortunately, I don't want to depress everyone at the end of the show, but a lot of those can often, you know, they sound like nuclear type explosions. And you know, the way the world is at the moment, it's the peace is quite precarious as well. So yeah, we may well be living in, and that's without me even talking about 2012 and Mayan prophecies.
That's another two-hour program.
Yes, exactly.
Aris, though, we hear in times. I think people envision this world like exploding and everybody's gone type of thing.
Yeah.
Why can't it just simply be a new beginning?
Yeah.
Isn't it possible that through the translations of the different languages that we misunderstood, that yes, we would have some horrific, challenging times, man would go on, but they would learn to change their ways?
Yeah, that, there's definitely an opportunity there. And even in Islamic prophecies as well, although it's described as a very dark time for the Muslims, saying that, you know, there'll be a time when there's not much left of their faith, they would have lost it. After that, there is like a renaissance and there's a rejuvenation, and there's no reason why that can't be, you know, done across the board as well. And I know there are people who much prefer that idea, that 2012, for instance, will be a time of, rather than cataclysm and the end, it will be like a new beginning or a rejuvenation or a shift in consciousness where we're more spiritual.
That would be nice.
It would be good, wouldn't it? That would be more positive, a more positive way to end the show, at least.
Right. there you go. No, I guess maybe just from my own research and the different areas and subjects that I research, and I am familiar with the 2012, the Mayan prophecies, the Hopi prophecies, all these other different things, too, is that I really do think something was lost in translation. To me, it just is not imaginable that, boom, man's gone. And that would be, well, a perfect waste of a brilliant creation. But maybe man just needs to be changed a little bit and set on a different path.
Yeah, maybe that, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Well, we can always
do. We've got front row seats. We'll see what happens.
There you go. There you go. Maybe we'll write the history. And, yeah, we won't do it for the power and the control. We'll just write it as it happened. Aris, we have 4 minutes left in the program. Is there anything that has not been brought up? I know we have several two-hour programs later on.
We've already got this scheduled up, haven't we?
I guess. Anything that you really wanted to impart on the listening audience?
Yeah, let me end with one last thing, which is a theme that seems to come up again and again when looking at this material. There's so many different researchers who have talked about the survival of the crucifixion and also the Jesus in India theory. But one thing that is quite interesting is, a common theme is that a lot of people have said that, you know what, there will come a time when the knowledge will become widespread and people will know the truth. Again and again, you'll hear researchers or even religious people saying, not many people know it now, but there will come a time when people will get to know about this. And, you know, I've only been involved with the Tomb of Jesus site for, you know, about 10 years. And during that time, there's been a big increase in the number of documentaries. You know, there's Paul David's films out there as well. And at least people are talking about it. Just the fact that me and you are having this conversation now and that your listeners are listening to it means that, you know, people are finding out more about it. And I think more and more evidence will come to light on these areas. And, watch this space is what I would say. Because this is an area that is growing all the time. It changes day by day. I got an email about 3-4 days ago about someone who had just written a new book on this topic, so who I had never heard of before. An Indian lady. I think she's based in this. So, there's new research and work being done by an ever-increasing number of people. And I'd also encourage everyone listening to this as well to go away and read up more about it and do your own research. And, you know, you can always contact me through the website, which I'll just give again. It's arifkhan.co.uk. That's arifkhan.co.uk.
Yeah. Well, and not to be afraid to look at something different.
Absolutely.
You know, that I don't know. I guess I can't stress that enough. I mean, obviously, Aris, there's a lot of stuff out there that's just like, yeah, right. You know, that really is bogus. I guess the biggest thing that I ever worry about is that somebody getting involved with a cult, something that's not positive, that's not moving in a good direction, and those risks are always out there. However, that does not mean that we have to shut everything out. I mean, I like reading about the Jesus in India theory. I enjoyed the documentary. It brought a whole new way, you know, of looking at history and the world, and it didn't take away anything from me that I was taught about who Jesus was as a man and what he offered to humanity.
Fully agree, and even these religions, although today they're so dogmatic, they're so narrow-minded, if you look at the scriptures, again, right there in the scriptures, you are told to question things and you are told to reflect. the Quran says, do not just follow the faith of your forefathers, but ask questions, you know, and keep looking and look around you. Don't close your mind off, but keep your mind open. It's a challenge, but it's something we should all do, is definitely keep an open mind to all of this stuff.
Right, and isn't that one of the most beautiful things about being a human, is that you can ask questions?
Absolutely.
Yeah, what would we do if we had none to ask?
Okay.
That would be the end of the world. Arif, I really enjoyed our interview. I really appreciate you getting up at 2 a.m. to be on the program with me.
No problem. It's been fun.
I wish you great success in the future, in your endeavors as a father, and yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I'm glad that you were with me. Everybody, you've been listening to Voice of the People on the Paranormal Radio Network. Next week, my guest is, hang on while I flip my paper here, author, oh my gosh, Mina or Mina, sorry if I pronounce it wrong, Parker. She's written a book called 365, excuse me, very interesting. There are daily inspirations that empower and inspire. That's those things that make you think and want to ask questions. I hope you enjoyed the program. Have a great week ahead.
Thank you for listening to the Voice of the People, host November Hansen on the Paranormal.